Today on Maine Calling, Neil deGrasse Tyson and Maine-based astronomers discuss big happenings in the night sky. Forget St. Patrick's Day. For astronomy buffs, the big event coming up is a rare total lunar eclipse. The Blood Moon lunar eclipse will be visible from most of North America early in the morning, March 14th. There's also a lot of buzz around some strange sightings from the James Webb Space Telescope, including a planet-sized object roaming through space. And of course, there's that newly discovered asteroid that may, theoretically, be on a collision course with Earth. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss all of this and more with author and astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson and two Maine-based astronomers. They're ready to answer your questions about stars, planets, our moon, and upcoming events in the night skies. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Maine Health, where care teams provide expert, coordinated care focused on your overall wellness to help you be your healthiest self, mainehealth.org, and by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Are you getting excited about the upcoming lunar eclipse? A little worried about that asteroid that seems to be headed towards Earth? Hoping someday that you might travel in space? Our guests today share your curiosity about space and are eager to share their knowledge. Joining me, Neil deGrasse Tyson, prominent astrophysicist and director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, and the author of numerous best-selling books and his most recent book, Merlin's Tour of the Universe, revised and updated for the 21st century, a traveler's guide to blue moons and black holes, Mars, stars, and everything far. Tyson will be in Maine March 19th for an event at Merrill Auditorium. Neil deGrasse Tyson, I think that that may be the longest title of a book I've read yet.
No, you blended in the subtitle. Subtitles always run away with themselves. The actual title of the book is Merlin's Tour of the Universe.
Okay. Yeah. Also with us for the show today, Sean Lotch, who's director of the Versant Power Astronomy Center at the University of Maine, and Neil Comans, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. We know you have questions about space because, well, every time we do a show about astronomy, you have them. Send an email, a brief email, to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson, we have two Neils today. I'll start with you. A lot of hubbub about this asteroid. Tell us about it and tell us if you're worried.
Oh, so here's what we should all be thinking about. What that asteroid did, it was a reminder that, you know what it was? It was nature sending a shot across our bow. And you do that when you say, hey, maybe we should look up and think about these a little more than we have been. Our ability to discover and track these asteroids will grow exponentially in the coming years. So news stories such as that one, this was the asteroid 2024 YR4. That was its phone number there, its ID. Asteroids such as that will become much more frequent in our awareness. These things were always flying by us. And we just never knew. That's correct. And so
this reminds me of the conversation we have in Maine about white sharks. Everybody's all excited because we're tracking more white sharks. But my understanding is we're just tracking them now. So this is what's going on.
Don't confuse our ability to know about their existence with any increased danger. You are always in danger.
Oh, gee, thanks. So, we're always in danger. Okay.
Yeah, just to put you at ease, this danger was always there. So what I liked about this round was the public and the press, there was a little bit of hyperbole there, but they were sort of with it as the frontier measurements for the risk factors evolved, and they would report that. And I thought that was a good sign. It's not often that the press will track with the science and respond to it in interesting ways. So it went from like 1% to a 3% risk of hitting Earth. And then so that was bad, but then it went back down, and then it went really far down. And but it was a good excuse to just talk about these risks. So I'm good. Don't worry about that one.
Don't worry about that one. But asteroids actually do hit the Earth from time to time, correct?
Well, we're in the same area of the solar system as the moon, and just take a look at the moon. The moon has been hit for billions of years. So the Earth just does a very good job covering up the evidence that we've been hit. There's some famous craters, like in Arizona. That one is beautifully preserved over tens of thousands of years. It's nearly a mile across. It could sink a 60-story building. And we think the asteroid that made that crater was about the same size as the one that did not hit us or will not hit us, that
Will
was
not hit
just
us in
reported in the press.
2032. That's right. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm going to turn to Sean and the other Neil for just a second. Sean, I know what you're most excited about right now is something happening next week. And I'm smiling because the last time I saw you, Sean Lotch, we were in Jackman, Maine for the total solar eclipse. What's happening next week is a total lunar eclipse. What is that? Does that mean that the Earth is blocking the moon on a night that the moon is full?
Yeah, so basically, with the lunar eclipse, you're seeing sort of opposite. In the case of a solar, you're at new moon, when the sun is blocked out by the moon temporarily, and the moon is casting a shadow here on Earth. In this case, the moon is passing through Earth's shadow at full moon, and that's going to be happening this week, Friday morning. It's going to start at 1:09 a.m. in the morning, so very early in the morning. Totality from about 2:26 to 2:31. With the maximum being at 2:58 a.m. And then it's going to end around 4:47 a.m. So if the weather is clear, and if and only if, I tell folks, you can feel free to show up here. We'll have the Clark Telescope open behind our building for free observing. Again, I know it's a Friday morning, the last day of the work week, so it may be a little bit difficult with those times, but we are going to try to be here from roughly 12:30 in the morning till 5 a.m. to give folks a chance to look at the moon, but also other objects as well while we're enjoying totality, if the weather again cooperates. That's always a big thing. The last lunar eclipse we had here in Maine, we were socked in with clouds, so it was eclipsed by clouds. So we're hoping this one will be clear.
Neil Cummins.
Yes, here's one of the fun facts about lunar eclipses. The moon is moving into our shadow, as Sean said. Absolutely right. And intuitively, it might sound like, well, if it's in our shadow, it should be dark and it should be maybe even invisible. But in fact, that's neither is the case. It is sort of an orange red. I don't know if there's probably a name for it. I don't know. But the point is that even when the moon is completely in our shadow, light from the sun is, it's called refracted, but it's bent around the Earth into the region behind the Earth. And the color of the light that gets bent most is red, reddish orange. And so the moon will not disappear completely.
Now, Neil, I remember growing up when air pollution was much greater than it is today, that the mid-eclipse was redder than I've seen lately. Lately, it's just kind of been dark and, with a little bit of red, but nothing so striking as I remembered growing up. Is it and it seems to me the pollution in the atmosphere would help redden that even further as it sort of refracted around Earth. Is that consistent with your thinking?
Yes, I would say so.
It'll be interesting this year with the forest fires that we've seen, and if we have, volcanic eruptions this year, with not so much, but some of the forest fires might give it more of a deeper reddish tint.
Now, I don't mean to pick a fight, but I'm always first to tell people how boring lunar eclipses are compared with solar eclipses. I just got to put it out there. The
Well,
fact that,
I don't think
wait,
anything can
Sean.
top a total solar eclipse, though. So
Exactly.
Right.
And
That's
Sean,
the thing.
You even implicitly admitted it when you said, "When you come, we'll look at other stuff too while the eclipse is
Yes.
going on."
Yeah. Well,
Yeah, right.
you have over an hour of totality, so that's the one thing. During a solar, you have a few minutes
Yeah.
maximum. Of course, and it's very, very, dynamic. And with lunars, you kind of can take your time and relax a bit and look at lots of other things
It's a
because you have
stately
over.
event, yes.
Right. But yeah, I will admit it's not nearly as exciting as the total solar eclipse, and we won the weather lottery last year for that, so we're really thrilled about that. But the last time we had a lunar eclipse, we didn't. We were clouded in, so and we don't have a full total lunar eclipse again until 2029 here in Maine. So kind of hoping we'll get one to show folks.
Neil Cummins.
So for the last total solar eclipse, I was invited to Mount Washington to, present and share with them. And that worked out really well, but it was only like 98.5% totality. The thing I want to emphasize in a solar eclipse, never ever, under any circumstance, look at the sun directly.
Right.
Because that will ca can cause serious blindness and other issues. So, get the glasses. They're cheap, they're fun.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, I know you can't stay with us for the whole hour, so I'm going to get to some questions that have already come into you. Merton on Facebook says, "Where would you have us look for life outside our solar system if you could get the powers that be to point all of our satellites and telescopes given the chance and why?"
Well, there's life, this simple life, microbial, that would be almost exciting to a biologist as intelligent life, just an entire other biosphere that may or may not even have DNA. And if it has DNA, they would have no DNA in common with us. So that it's not likely we would find microorganisms outside of the solar system anytime soon. But within our solar system, we're looking where we think there's water. Like Europa, there's a mission just launched, the Europa Clipper, that's going to get close to one of Jupiter's moons. Europa is as an icy shell, but tidal stressing on Europa has melted the water inside. There's an ocean of liquid water, been liquid for billions of years, and we think there's more water there than all the waters of Earth's oceans. And all evidence shows that life began in Earth's oceans. So it's tantalizing to wonder what could have evolved deep within the crust of Europa. Also, the subsurface layers in Mars, we know there's water there, and we see it's seeping out from the sides of ravines. And if there's an aquifer, microbial life could be thriving there. We just don't know yet. Not on the surface, because there's a lot of UV from the sun that isn't blocked, and UV is hostile to biology. So that's that. Outside of this, who knows? There's a new cottage industry in modern astrophysics, and we're looking for biomarkers. This is cool, where you look in the atmosphere of exoplanets, and there's a way to do that if they pass in front of their host star. Light from the host star passes through the atmosphere and gets tagged by the chemistry of that atmosphere. So there's certain chemicals, gaseous chemicals, that really have no business being there unless life on the surface created it. And free oxygen, for example, would be one of them. There's no oxygen on Earth unless life, plant life specifically, actively produced it. So we have a list of such chemicals that we're looking for. And that way we would be able to detect if there was life there, whether or not it was what we would call intelligent.
All right. So interesting. Is this the case, like you're talking about asteroids, we're going to know about more because we can track them better? I mean, is the pace of knowledge about potential life forms on other planets increasing at the same kind of rate?
Yes.
You all are all not. I just want to note that all three scientists here are nodding. Neil Cummins, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to agree. It's amazing how much and how fast we are learning about things in that realm. And I would not be in the least bit surprised if in the next decade we do find life elsewhere, whether it's in the solar system or nearby stars, somewhere. I'm saying 10 years.
Yeah, I would add that it was 1995. I guess that's how, I guess that's 30 years ago. Is it really? Wow. Okay. So 1995 was the discovery of the first exoplanet, a planet orbiting another star. And then now that number is rising through 6,000. So back then it was banner headlines anytime one of them was discovered. And now it's just happening every week and no one cares about it anymore, which is a good sign. It means we're now growing accustomed to this. And what I do, any if I'm in a public setting and I ask, I get a show of hands, who here is 30 or under? And they raise their hand and I say, I now declare you to be Generation Exoplanet. They've known life only with catalogs, plush with planets. So yeah, so the things are going exponentially. As you'd expect, that's what happens. We live in an exponential era of growth of science and technology.
All right. Well, since you were talking about people under 30, I'll go to this question from Madden on Facebook. He's 13 and a budding astrophysicist. He's going to see you at Merrill next week. He says, what new areas of study do you see being available for someone my age who still has 10 years of school left before starting my career?
I got a good answer for that, but I'd want to hear what Neil and Sean also have to say. I can tell you that the pace at which things are advancing and growing means no matter what I tell them now, it could be different in 10 years or 15 years or 20. So what you have to do is stay open to all the different areas as they progress. And often they're great advances because there's a telescope of a particular type that pushes forward faster than we otherwise would go, or a probe, or some other new understanding of the universe that comes in. And so I don't know that I would pre-choose, given the rate at which new fields open up within the main fields that we're talking about.
Sean, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's the thing with astronomy. There's always new discoveries along the way, so you do want to stay open. I know some topics that have been hot for a while and we're still trying to figure out, and have been for a while, are the whole question of dark matter and dark energy. We're getting closer on dark matter. Dark energy is still probably farther out there. So those are a couple areas you might at least poke around in, but I agree that, with all the new telescopes that are coming online and new space-based instrumentation, yeah, you want to wait and see what's the hot topic as you get closer to your college. The big thing I would say is take as much computers as you can get in, and math and science. If you do those three things, you'll be setting yourself up for success going forward in a career in science.
Math as the language of the universe. You want to talk to the universe, bring in the math, and you can't go wrong.
Neil Cummins.
Yeah, no, first of all, I totally agree. I'm teaching a senior level college course in cosmology, and the math that is necessary to understand that is challenging, shall we say, for the students in my class. And so it's been, one step at a time. I've got to take them through that. And so if younger people can learn the math slash physics better, they will be in a better place for advancing their understanding when they get to, the end of their college career, and give them even more insight into how to proceed in their professional career.
And Neil, I haven't seen your curriculum, but I bet you that the cosmology you and I learned when in graduate school is it's makes no appearance in the cosmology course you're teaching now, given how far cosmology has come since then.
I couldn't agree more. It is truly phenomenal. So, yes.
One of you, Niels, tell me what we mean by cosmology.
Oh
How's
yes,
that
don't
different
confuse it
than
with
astronomy?
Don't confuse it with cosmetology. That's completely different. Okay. Completely different. I'll give like a 30-second overview here. Until the late 1800s, astronomy was not much more than where's the object in the sky? Is it moving? What color is it? And what are its coordinates? Is there anything else I can think about it back then? Then spectroscopy came in, where you can put the light through a prism and analyze analyzed features of that object that took us into the realm of physics. So the chemical composition, the atomic structure, so when that happened, all astronomers basically became astrophysicists because you can't think about the universe without invoking high-level physics to understand what's going on. And now, within astrophysics, there are subfields. Cosmology, they tend to worry about the Big Bang and stuff that happened after that. And then you have the planetary scientists. They're almost not astrophysicists because they can go there. If you can go there and do an experiment, then that's tabletop science at that level. The rest of us, we're stuck with just light coming through a telescope. So, but they're cottage industries within astrophysics, one of which is cosmology.
All right. Well, we do need to take a break. We are talking with, boy, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Sean Lotch, and Neil Cummins, and we are answering your questions about space. What are they? 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about the latest astronomical news and taking your questions. My guests are Neil deGrasse Tyson, the director of the Hayden Planetarium. His latest book is Merlin's Tour of the Universe. Neil Cummins is with us as well. He's a UMaine professor of physics and astronomy. And Sean Lotch is director of the UMaine Versant Power Astronomy Center. Join the conversation. What are you wondering about when you look into the night sky? Send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainpublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We'll go up to Lewiston and Paul. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Oh, my gosh. I get to talk to Neil deGrasse Tyson. How exciting! Big fan. So I just wanted to touch base with the James Webb Telescope being like the hugest astronomical feat within, I would say, the last 50 years, and getting all these spectacular images. We're hyper-focused on this one asteroid, but if the universe is infinite, isn't there infinite amount of floating objects we should be worried about, or is this one more important than the rest of them?
Yeah, so I mean, the actual universe may be infinite, but not all of that infinite universe matters to us, only what's within our horizon. And these are objects that have been sent light that we're only just now receiving, that it sent 14 billion years ago. But that's separate from the issue of the asteroid, that an asteroid that could hit us. There's all this leftover debris in the solar system from back when the solar system formed. And the catalogs of asteroids, I would check with Sean, he might have an updated number on how many asteroids are flitting about. Most of them are safe, orbiting between Mars and Jupiter, the asteroid belt, but there's a subset of them, and I think the number is at least in the hundreds of thousands, have wayward orbits that cross the orbit of the Earth. And the task going forward will be to catalog them, know their orbits, so that you can project forward if we are at risk. We will ultimately be at risk for getting hit by 100% of those asteroids. The question is it 10 years, 50 years, 1,000 years? And then you arrange your civilization accordingly in response to those risks. Sure,
Can we
do you have an
protect our?
updated number on asteroids?
I know that with the Atens, the Apollos, and the Mors, which are near-Earth asteroids, that I think that the recent number I heard was over 20,000 or so of them that cross our path. And roughly, it's been about 12 or 13 years ago now, we had the event in Chelyabinsk in Russia, where basically you had an object that was about the size of a school bus. That blew out windows, and actually about 2,000 people got injured by shattered glass from that. So again, we know we've been hit before. It's a matter of time. The idea is to see it before it's coming, so it's not a surprise, so we don't go the way of the dinosaurs. And NASA even had a mission a few years ago called DART, Double Asteroid Redirect Test. They love their acronyms. But basically, that was used to give an asteroid a push, which is what we'd want to do if we discovered one that was a threat to us. But we'd have to discover it early enough to get something launched and then give it a push off the track so that it wouldn't hit us. We're not going to be able to do an Armageddon or deep impact thing. That's not realistic. But we could give an asteroid a slight push if we discovered it early enough. to make sure that we don't go the way of the dinosaurs.
Plus, those 20,000 asteroids, I think those are only the known asteroids.
Right.
There'll be smaller ones that telescopes will put into the catalog, which will be more frequent, although less disastrous if they hit. So there's an interesting trade-off there. Yeah.
Paul, thanks for your question. We'll go up to Beth and Sean. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi. Nice to talk with you, Neil. I just have a question for you and maybe for everyone. When I was watching the most recent Earthrise video from the lunar lander, which was beautiful, a question that popped into my mind was, what messages of hope do you have for the future of humanity, considering our present seems so uncertain?
Well, we all surely have a comment on that. I'm happy to lead off here. First, that Earthrise, Earth doesn't actually rise when viewed from the moon, because the side of the moon that faces Earth always faces Earth. So Earth neither rises nor sets. When it was rising, by view of the astronauts, it's because they were in orbit around the Earth. They were in orbit around the moon. And in doing so, of course, the Earth would rise and set. So it's a little misleading to call that Earthrise. That's all, because it gives a false impression of what's actually going on. But I can tell you this, when we first saw that image from Apollo 8 in 1968, December, and it was, oh my gosh, that's Earth. And you know, it didn't look like, it wasn't color coded with countries the way the Earth globe was in the back of our classrooms. It was as nature intended you to see Earth, with mountains and oceans and land. And there's a certain oneness to that image that I think transformed civilization. When that image appeared, we began the Environmental Protection Agency and the NOAA,
National Organization,
Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and that TV commercial with the Native American crying, that happened while we were on the moon looking back towards Earth. So we were changed after that image. And I'd like to think that we're overdue for perhaps another soul-searching, emotion-shifting image, typically from space, to have us take stock in who we are to each other and our relationship to Earth and what we need to do to make sure we are not the seeds of our own demise.
That's a big question Sean posed, and boy, Neil, you stepped up to it. Thank you so much.
Oh, okay.
Let's see here. I'll go to an email here that says, hold on just a second. Oh, this is one for you, Sean. In January, the Southworth Planetarium here in Portland staged a play in the dome about the Hubble Deep Field and an autistic cosmologist for four sold-out performances. How likely is the planetarium to stage a play, another play like that?
Sure. We've done two plays here at the planetarium. Back in 2017, we did one called Constellations, of course, where we had live actors in our dome. And then we did one it was the spring before the eclipse. We did Silent Sky, which was about the life of Henrietta Leavitt, one of the computers at Harvard, who basically gave us a good chunk of our stellar classification scheme. So we've done some live plays. We do have one that we're planning. Just a quick,
that's back when the word computer referred to a human being.
Yes. Exactly. Yep. And we do have a play coming up in November of this year called Cosmogenesis. We've been working with the Fisk Planetarium out in Boulder, Colorado, and they have a playwright there that has created a program about a young female high school student who is exploring her world and wants to go into the field of sort of astronomy and cosmology. And so it talks a little bit about her journey and how she gets excited by it. So that's going to be our play that's going to be coming up in November of this year.
Cool.
So
and I didn't read the whole question, because the end is how likely is the Hayden hint hint planetarium to stage a play?
The last time we staged a performance was some time ago. And so it hasn't been in our It's not in our repertoire of late. We have all these other things we're doing, bringing in sort of speakers and this sort of thing. So, but the artistic dimension is a very important one, because so many people's access to science might be through an artistic conduit. And of course, a planetarium dome is it was probably people's first ever virtual reality experience. I mean, think about that. And so much of what would happen on Broadway or wherever else where you're staging a play, they want to set the mood with the set design and all the rest of this. If you have a dome, oh my gosh, you're completely immersed in what it is you're portraying. So there's nothing like a dome space for just that kind of exposure.
Yeah, and coming up on the 100th anniversary in May of this year. So May 7th is the sort of the official 100th anniversary of planetariums, and the International Planetarium Society has a number of special events planned for that day, just to sort of highlight again 100 years of having these dome spaces to share the universe with everyone.
We'll go to Louise calling from Orrington. Hi, Louise, go ahead.
Hi. We were really moved by viewing the total solar eclipse in Maine, and I was wondering if you could tell us, if we were willing to travel, where we might see another solar eclipse in the coming years.
Neil Cummins, do you know the answer to that?
I honestly don't know.
That's why we have Sean. Sean knows.
Yeah. Okay, Sean knows.
He's the one.
Yeah, so next August, there's going to be one that passes through Greenland, Iceland, and Spain.
Ooh, not too far. And,
yeah, not too far away. So that's next August. If you're waiting here in Maine, you're going to have to wait till 2079. So that's a little bit out. But I don't know. I'll be around for that one. I would like to be, but probably not. But yeah, next August, there'll be one Greenland, Iceland, and Spain. And so Spain will be the best place to be for that weather-wise, more than likely. So I would urge folks to check that out. We do have a partial solar eclipse coming up on the 29th of this month at sunrise here in Maine. It's going to start around 6:20 in the morning as it's going to be eclipsed as the sun rises. This is only a partial, so not nearly as spectacular as what we had last April. And it'll finish a little after around 7:11 in the morning. About 87% or so will be eclipsed. You still need your solar eclipse glasses to see that. Again, we do have some here at the planetarium if need be. But again, that's going to be just a partial happening, a sunrise partial coming up at the end of the month. But those are opportunities to see solar eclipses going forward.
And by the way, to watch a setting or rising sun that's eclipsed, that's just a stunning view. I mean, oh my gosh, because then it's juxtaposed with your horizon. But I'll add here that if you've never seen a total solar eclipse, you've never seen a total solar eclipse.
Exactly.
if you've seen a partial eclipse at 99%, you haven't seen a total eclipse.
Exactly.
That 1% sunlight coming through is as bright as the brightness of 10,000 full moons. So don't come to me and say, oh, I think I saw a total. No, you didn't.
You would know.
You would know.
Please, thank you. And I'm going to go here to an email from Robin. She writes, I enjoyed Neil's book, The Pluto Files, and was very entertained by the inclusion of hate mail from both eight-year-olds and astronomers alike. I was wondering if Neil still gets messages like that, or has the controversy died down and the discourse moved on? And of course,
great
Neil,
question. So,
this is about Pluto no longer being
Pluto,
a planet, right?
Yeah, it's the plutocracy, the plutocalypse that happened in 2006. In my institution, we were early out of the box to reorganize Pluto away from the other planets. And that got noticed by the New York Times, and they had a front page headline below the fold, but page one that said, Pluto not a planet, only in New York. And then all the anger and ire started pointing towards me. And I have a file cabinet of an entire drawer of hate mail from elementary school children who had just freshly memorized the sequence of planets from the sun. The famous, my very educated mother just served us 9 pizzas. And one of them says, now without Pluto, how am I going to memorize this? It's like, okay, dude, it's just my very educated mother just served us nachos. How about that? So no more. The hate mail has stopped because all of them would ultimately enter middle school and high school with other hormonal concerns in their lives. And the next generation is now grown up only ever knowing that Pluto was demoted. So the anger part is gone from society.
Sean, when you give shows, do you still have people who are upset about the demotion of Pluto?
Not so much upset, but oftentimes what I find is people are like, oh, well, Pluto's no longer there. And it's like, no, it's still part of our solar system. It's still an important part of our solar system. We've just happened to have discovered many other dwarf, planets out there beyond, like Eris and Haumea and Maki Maki and Sedna and Quarar, and the list goes on and on. So we've discovered all these other Kuiper Belt objects out there, but Pluto is still part of our solar system. It's just, and I always tell it's been reclassified, not really demoted. And I'd like to use it as a chance to say that science, when we get new information, when we get new evidence in, we change based on that. We're not dogmatic. We will update our science, based on the latest facts and evidence, which is really important, I think, in our modern world.
Well, unfortunately, we have to take another quick break. We're going to continue to discuss astronomy, the night sky. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, we're talking about the night sky and things coming up. We're also asking some pretty big questions. My guest today, Neil Cummins, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Maine. Sean Lotch, director of the Versant Power Astronomy Center, also at the University of Maine. And a name you may have heard, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who has published 21 books on astronomy. Share your comments and questions. Send us an email, talk@mainpublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. We have a question right here from the studio from Jane, what we call our board op, the person doing the sound for this show. And I'm not sure I'm even going to be able to read it, Jane, but she says, she wants to know if you all have any theories about Przybylski's star. Did I pronounce it any even closely? You guys don't even know what I'm talking about. How about Przybylski star?
Yeah, I could honestly say I don't think I've heard of that one.
Is that the star they think there might be aliens building something that traps the light from the star as a Dyson sphere? Is it one of those?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So if it is that, so the idea is if you're an advanced civilization and you need energy, you might not have like dead fossilized plant life that became oil under your ground. Where would you get your energy? You get it from your host star. Now, why rely only on the light from the host star that reaches your planet? Why not grab all of it, all the light that's going in every direction? So you'd build this sphere around your star, channel all that energy to your planet, and then do what you will with it. If that's the case, if we look out into the night sky, we would see stars just disappearing because aliens are building these spheres out of the need for energy. By the way, there are opaque gas clouds out there that sometimes pass in front of stars that would change their brightness. I would lean towards natural explanations before I start invoking aliens. The urge is strong. Hollywood has trained us to explain everything with the alien cause. But I would bet that for stars such as that, if we get a better understanding of its environment, we would learn that there are reasons why the light is dimming other than what would be alien architecture.
Oh, man, aliens are more fun, though.
They're way more fun. Completely more fun.
We'll go to Anthony calling from West Gardner. Hi, Anthony. Go ahead.
I want to know why you never talk about Lyra, the 62 after ice planet, rocky world like Earth. And it's a gigantic ice planet.
Lyra, the ice planet. Anthony wants Lyra to get more attention.
Well, keep considering there, like I said, there's nearly 6,000 exoplanets out there, and we're right now cataloging them by their properties, right? Some are gaseous, some are icy, some are rocky, some are as best as we can make these measurements. So then there's like planets orbiting the nearest star to the sun. That's cool. If you're going to go to, so we're talking about in the Alpha Centauri star system, the nearest of that star system is Proxima Centauri. We got Earth-like planets orbiting that star. Oh my gosh. So I don't see why any one should be, they're all good to study. And so I'm not here to set priorities so much as to celebrate the fact that we're on a frontier of discovery of it all.
Anthony, thanks for your question. We'll go to Kathy calling from Brunswick. Hi, Kathy, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, given how far the James Webb Telescope is looking back into the universe, do these cosmic structures still exist?
I didn't hear the last part of your question well.
So given how far the James Webb Telescope is looking back into the universe, do those cosmic structures it sees still exist?
Ah, okay. I'm going to go to Neil because this seems like this kind of thing a college student would ask you, Neil.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, right. The short answer is it depends on how these things evolve. If they are like stars, they evolve significantly and they blow up and they're no longer what they were when we see them that far away. So many of the things that we see far, far away are not the same as if we were to suddenly go there and see them today.
Okay.
Yeah.
All of this gets a little mind-bending. I want to see how you guys, I want to ask just the big question of how you keep from just sort of having your mind blown on a daily basis when you're thinking about things like this.
No, that's the good part when your mind gets blown.
Yeah,
the issue, the difference is you embrace the fact when that happens. You don't shy away from it, and that keeps us jumping out of bed every morning to entertain the next day's discoveries. It's a celebration of ignorance rather than something you would shy away from.
Okay, Kathy, thanks for your question. We'll go to Fairfield and George. Hi, George, go ahead.
Oh, hi, thanks. I wasn't sure you'd actually get to me. I'm in the worst possible position to talk here. Well, this is for Dr. Tyson. Neil, it's a pleasure to actually get to speak with you. And I'm just going to kind of throw a positive statement out here for you to, you don't have to get detailed, but it's just for you to either refute or deny, take a position. And the position and the statement is this: so all pollution that whether it absorbs, refracts, or otherwise light energy that comes from the sun, stops that energy from reaching the earth, the terrestrial earth, be it water, earth, whatever. And therefore, whether it's volcanic activity, forest fires, tailpipe pollution, all pollution ultimately mitigates the heating effect of the solar energy from the sun and is therefore not the demon that we've made it out to be. We've put we put clean air against our the needs of the planet, and we are ourselves deliberately warming the planet. And only someone like Dr. Tyson can speak to this on a platform that others will finally respect. What is that you have to say to that, sir?
So it is true that the pollution we've been putting in the air since the Industrial Revolution, mostly the burning of fossil fuels, holding aside the CO2, just hold that aside for the moment, just particulates in the air have prevented sunlight from reaching Earth's surface that would have otherwise reached were it not for that particulate pollution, volcanoes included. So what that means is the warming was less than it otherwise would have been had that not been the case. So now that we care about clean air, there's more solar flux reaching Earth's surface, and that's now exacerbating the climate change effects that the CO2 has been driving. So that's definitely the case. What you need to do, however, is look at the numbers for how many people die of respiratory diseases from that pollution every year. It's in the millions worldwide. So what it means is the solution is not, hey, let's make more pollution. It's let's be clever about this and figure out, save the people's breathing, prevent people from dying of breathing illnesses, and find some other way to protect Earth. So that's a nuance that was not widely publicized, but it's definitely the truth.
Let me just throw in a follow-up comment to that. The radiation from the sun that does not get to the Earth because of particles, etc., in the atmosphere, heats the atmosphere. So that is also affecting the Earth, not directly, but indirectly.
George, thank you.
Upper levels of the atmosphere. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
Thanks for your question. I wanted to go to an email here from Joe. Neil deGrasse Tyson will be featured as Unity Environmental University's commencement speaker at Merrill Auditorium in Portland in May. So you're
looking
coming here
to
Maine twice this spring.
Twice. Yes.
Fantastic. Let's see here. We are going to, Maura here says, and I hope I pronounced your name right, a small group of people are working to protect the dark night sky here in Maine. We are proud to have one of the few dark sky parks over Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. We're at the point of encouraging towns to pass ordinances that regulate the kind of lighting people have around houses and businesses. It's not always an easy argument to make. I wonder if Dr. deGrasse Tyson would have an approach to encouraging and engaging people to protect the dark sky, perhaps some rationale that might be more appealing to people than we're reaching now.
Yeah, I think Sean surely has much more to say and think about this than I have. Well, all I would say is if you're in an airplane flying over a city and you can see a streetlight from your airplane, it means someone paid to have that streetlight illuminate the sky. You're seeing the streetlight and you're flying over the town. That's someone paid for that energy to do that. If the light is instead directed downward towards the street, you need less light to accomplish that. That's cheaper, less of a production, energy production load. And so everybody benefits. You get a dark sky, beautiful nights, you save money. It's the saving money part that matters here. And Tucson, Arizona, which pioneered the dark sky ordinances in the service of a nearby observatory on a mountaintop, they got together, and the astronomers and the residents said, let's do this so we're both good. And so, Sean, what else do you have to add to that? I'm sure you've thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, there's all this light that gets wasted, and it's a huge cost, but also it's our circadian rhythms and everything else. I mean, it's really good for, you know, all of us to preserve our night sky, because it helps life here on Earth too, you know, not just the energy side, but also our circadian rhythms. It also is important for animal migrations and birds and turtles and things of that nature. So there's so many reasons to protect the night sky. And so many people haven't seen the Milky Way. Maine is one of the darkest, you know, has some of the darkest skies on the East Coast, but we are losing them. And yeah, particularly these bright, you know, LED lights that a lot of cities are putting in are really problematic. And you want the light, you know, on the ground where, again, it makes things safe versus up in the sky where it doesn't do anything and light the underbellies of planes.
Yeah, and we've done whole programs on this, and we'll do it again. I'm going to go to an email from Allison. In the movie Interstellar, the time on the planets worked differently. Is it possible that there could be a planet or galaxy universe out there where time runs backwards? Like the Big Bang is the end instead of the beginning. So, Neil deGrasse Tyson, you have about a minute to answer that question.
I'd love that. I don't know of a way that would be the case. It happens to be so in physics that antimatter is physically identical to ordinary matter moving backwards through time in all of the experiments one would conduct. But I don't know how practical that is to think about the whole universe that way. So that would just be kind of fun. That's an overdue science fiction story, for sure. And by the way, Merlin as a character, not Merlin as I wrote in the book, Merlin lives backwards through time. in the legend. So someone has thought about it before we have.
Someone has thought about it. Boy, what a fun hour. And I apologize to everybody whose questions we were not able to get to. But boy, what a popular show. And thank you so much. Of course, the voice you just heard, Neil deGrasse Tyson, he's coming to Merrill Auditorium. Apparently just a few tickets left. That's March 19th, and also has a new book out. Also with us, Sean Lotch, director of the Versant Power Astronomy Center. And also, Neil Cummins, a professor at the University of Maine. Thank you all, Professor of Physics and Astronomy. Today's sound engineer is Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. If you want to ask a question ahead of time to a program, check out our new Talk to Us app. It's actually part of the Maine Public app, and it's super easy. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.